Good evening. It is 7 o'clock in the Midwest, and this is KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week for Monday, March 29th. I'm Dennis Hart. Welcome to another in our series of live programs in this time slot, where we explore and analyze what's going on at Iowa's state capital. Legislation that's in the works, legislation that could be in the works, and what it all means for all of us. As always, I'm joined by Laura Bellin of the must-read political blog site Bleeding Heartland. Laura, good to be with you again on this Monday night.
Nice to be with you, Dennis.
Laura, it was another busy week, but let's start out with something that happened just this afternoon, a few hours ago, when there was news reported from the state Senate that someone associated with the Senate has tested positive for the coronavirus. What do we know about this?
Unfortunately, we don't know really any more than what you just said. They announced that there was a positive case associated with the Iowa Senate. They didn't confirm whether it was a member of the Senate or a clerk or a legislative staffer or a page. They didn't confirm where in the chamber the person is normally seated. And so some of the Senate Democrats were upset this afternoon because they feel that, I mean, that people have no idea whether they've been exposed if they were in the chamber. And it's also worth mentioning that the Iowa House and the Iowa Senate did not pass any sort of rule requiring that people wear masks in the chamber. And quite a few of the Republican legislators and staff routinely do not wear masks when they're in the chamber.
This is not the first time that the coronavirus has been detected in the state legislature. It's the first time in a little while, but there were some other cases.
Yes, yeah, so there were several cases, more actually associated with the House than the Senate. But again, also reporting of these positive tests is voluntary under the legislative rules. So we really don't know that whether the ones that have been publicized are the only cases associated with the legislature. We know those are the cases where people have voluntarily reported to the top staffers in each chamber that they have tested positive.
We don't know where this is going to go because this is just about as new for you and me as it is for anybody else right now. We're just finding out about this, but we do know that cases of the coronavirus are going up in many states across the United States, even as vaccinations are put out there, and that the director of the CDC has been begging people for the last week to please wear masks, to please social distance, but it seems to be falling on some deaf ears around the United States, a lot of deaf ears.
Yeah, and Iowa, unfortunately, is one of the top states right now for the positivity rate, which is the percentage of tests that come back positive. Now, the positivity rate is a lot lower now than it was in October, November, December, but it's still high. It's higher than the national average, and it's rising. And hospitalizations, after they took a long, steady slide up until late February and early March, they've ticked back up again since then. So hovering around 200 hospitalizations statewide, and it's concerning. The state of Michigan right now is in a full-blown third wave outbreak, and their hospitalizations have gone substantially up. I've been trying to find out, there are several variants of COVID-19 that are of concern. One that's been identified in Iowa is called the UK variant. I've been trying to get information from the State Department of Public Health about what counties that's been located in. 2 weeks ago, I was told that it had been identified in 19 counties, and I've been trying to get an update to find out how many more counties this variant is circulating in. In the UK, this was associated with higher hospitalizations and more deaths, unfortunately.
And unfortunately, this whole vaccine has been politicized. New polls have shown consistently that a considerable minority of Republicans will not get the vaccine. In fact, 49% of Republican men in the most recent poll I saw, a national poll, say they're not going to get vaccinated. So it's become politicized like everything else in American society.
Yeah, and Ann Seltzer, who's the pollster for the Des Moines Register, they included a question about this in the most recent Iowa poll they did, which was in the field in the first week of March. And they found that overall statewide, 27% said they don't plan to get a COVID-19 vaccine. But among Republicans, it was 41% don't plan to be vaccinated, compared to 8% of the Democrats in the sample and 30% of the independents. And we can start to see that a little bit on, there are some accounts where you can keep track of open vaccination appointments around the state. And in some rural counties, we're starting to see they have more open appointments. In fact, this week, there are some counties that are opening up vaccines to everybody over age 16 rather than just people with underlying conditions and people over age 65, because apparently they have extra doses and they've had trouble finding people to take those appointments. Now, in other counties, they're still struggling to get through those priority populations, including people over 65 and the ones with pre-existing health conditions. So you can sort of see that in the more Republican-leaning areas, there may be a lot of people refusing to get vaccinated.
Perhaps it should go without saying, but I guess we have to say it on this Monday night. The coronavirus doesn't care whether you're a Democrat, Republican, or independent. It'll come after you.
That's right. And it's going to complicate our efforts to get to herd immunity in Iowa if there are areas, you know, some counties in Iowa, routinely Republican candidates get more than 70% of the vote. So if you think about that's a sizable part of the population who might be refusing a vaccine, and it might prevent us from getting herd immunity. Now, of course, some people who are refusing the vaccine, it's possible that they already had the virus last year or this year, but we don't know how long immunity is lasting. We don't know whether that immunity is effective against the new variants that might come up and become more prevalent. So it's definitely a concern for public health officials.
Let's talk about the Iowa District Congressional 2 race. When I say race, I'm talking about what happened in November when Republican Marionette Miller Meeks defeated Democrat Rita Hart by six votes out of nearly 400,000. It is a mess. Rita Hart has appealed to the state U.S. House of Representatives. Nothing happened today, but House Republican Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy sent a letter to Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi late this afternoon urging her to dismiss Hart's effort to overturn the results of the race. So let's unpack that. It's just a mess.
Yeah. So there's something called the Federal Contested Elections Act that was passed in the late 1960s. And it provides a process for candidates for the U.S. House or Senate to appeal directly to Congress. That the U.S. Constitution says that Congress has the final say over who wins elections and who is seated as its members. And this Federal Contested Elections Act lays out a process for that. So there have been well over 100 contests filed under this federal law. And that's what the process that Rita Hart has used. In the state law, unfortunately, the state law required that any election contest be resolved by December 8th. And that's really not a very long time to potentially recount almost 400,000 votes. There was an election contest after a very close Iowa House race in 2018, and it took weeks just to consider. There were 29 disputed ballots in that. They ended up never being opened or considered, but it took weeks to work through that contest for one Iowa House district. So think about an Iowa congressional district that has 24 counties. So the process now is that the House Administration Committee is considering a filings filed by lawyers for both sides. Rita Hart is the Democrat, Marionette Miller Meeks is the Republican, and the Republicans just keep filing statements essentially saying that this should be dismissed, it shouldn't even be considered, and they haven't made any concrete arguments against the ballots that Rita Hart's campaign has identified. They've just made procedural arguments that this election was certified in Iowa. Rita Hart didn't appeal through the Iowa courts, and that should be the end of the story. So the Hart campaign has sworn affidavits from 22 voters who say that their ballots were not counted. 18 of those say that they voted for Rita Hart. Three of them voted for Miller Meeks, and one didn't check any box by the congressional election. So the Hart campaign maintains that if all of those ballots were counted, that she would be ahead by 15 votes instead of ahead by 9 votes rather than behind by 6. So we'll see. I expect that the House Administration Committee will proceed and investigate this complaint. I mean, it often happens that one side asks them to dismiss and not consider a complaint. And usually they do end up considering the appeal. Now, that doesn't mean that they will find that Rita Hart is the winner and seat Rita Hart. I mean, in 1996, there was a very close election in California. The House was under Republican control at the time, and the losing candidate, the Republican, filed an appeal through the same Federal Contested Election Act process. And the Democrat, Loretta Sanchez, she had been sworn in already, and she argued that it should be dismissed, and it wasn't dismissed. They fully investigated the complaint, but then they determined that, in fact, the Democrat had won the election. So they didn't change. The fact that they might investigate the complaint doesn't mean that Rita Hart would automatically be seated.
Now, there is a group of U.S. House members, Democrats, who really don't want this to come to a vote on the floor of the House because they are considered moderate Democrats. They do not want to be in position to have to vote to overturn the election of a Republican in the House because it would lead to absolute nuclear warfare in the U.S. House of Representatives.
Yeah, and the Republican-aligned groups are already running ads in some of those House members' districts to encourage them not to do this. So it's very possible that this matter will never come to a vote before the full House. The last time there was this close an election that was actually where the outcome was reversed was in 1985 in Indiana's 8th District. And after a series of recounts, the Democrat was declared the winner by 4 votes. McCloskey was his name, so people used to call him Landslide McCloskey. And the House did vote to seat him, but 10 Democrats dissented from that vote. And at that time, the Democratic majority in the U.S. House was considerably larger than it is now. So Democrats do not have 10 votes to lose. They don't even really have 5 votes to lose on this thing. So I would say, you know, right now, I would guess that Marionette Miller Meeks will remain in Congress, but that's not to say that the committee won't thoroughly investigate this, and we'll have to see where it goes. I mean, the Republicans are, they're pushing this messaging that this is Pelosi's steal and Pelosi's going to steal the seat. I mean, this House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is not in a position to steal the seat. I mean, there's no way that this would even come to a vote unless the House Administration Committee investigates and finds that Rita Hart actually received more votes from eligible Iowans who cast ballots in those 24 counties.
All right. That's a quick open to the broadcast. It's 12 minutes after the hour of 7 o'clock in the Midwest, Monday night. This is KHOI's Capital Week. I'm Dennis Hart and she is Laura Bellin. And I'm glad she's Laura Bellin because she always amazes me with what she knows. Laura, I learn something from you every single Monday night. Let's talk about the State House, our actual Iowa State House, which passed a bill last week expanding open enrollment for Iowa students, increasing tax credits offered to Iowans, and passed a bill that would create new pathways to establish, dare I mention it, charter schools. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, so this is all part of the governor's agenda. She proposed a pretty wide-ranging school bill that contained a lot of these elements, including vouchers and open enrollment and increasing the tuition tax credit and textbook tax credit. These are things that help people who send their kids to private schools. Iowa actually assists families who send their kids to private schools more than a lot of states do. So in the Iowa Senate, they passed an amended version of what the governor wanted, all as one bill. But in the House, they ran into a roadblock on this voucher provision, largely because the superintendents and the school boards were very against it, and including in rural areas. So what the House has done, a piecemeal approach where they've taken bits of this bill and tried to pass it as standalone measures. So the open enrollment, that would make it easier for people to pull their kids out of the district where they live and send their kids to another district. It would affect a few districts, including Des Moines, that have voluntary diversity plans. In the city of Des Moines, depending on where you live, if you're white, you may be denied if you try to open enroll your child out of that district into another district. And under this bill, that would not be possible. The school districts that have these voluntary diversity plans would not be able to use those to deny open enrollment requests. Also, athletes who use open enrollment to try to play for a different school would have to wait less of a time. The governor actually wanted it to be an immediate thing where athletes could transfer and play for the other team, other school right away. And what the House did is they've just shortened that. And the tuition tax credit, they doubled that. And those were, I mean, that's something that most Democrats didn't support, but it wasn't nearly as controversial as the charter school bill. This thing was a real mess. And they say, you know, the House has a rule that they're not supposed to have any debate after midnight. But a few times a year, things go so late that they end up suspending that rule. And that happened last Wednesday when this charter school bill came to the floor. The Democrats had offered many, many amendments to it. The current law says school districts can start their own public charter schools, and only 2 have done so. So this bill would say that a group of people living in an area can bypass the school district, the school board, and they can go straight to the Iowa Department of Education and start their own charter school. So it really would be, it would allow a lot of non-public schools with minimal oversight to just start operating. And the Democrats where they used some procedural maneuvers that you don't often see. So one thing was the ranking Democrat on the House Appropriations Committee actually demanded an impromptu meeting of the House Appropriations Committee because they said that this bill would have a budgetary impact that hadn't been determined. So at like 11 p.m. last Wednesday, they took a break from their House floor proceedings and they had a meeting of the House Appropriations Committee. They didn't come to any conclusions, but then while the bill was technically in committee, the same Democrat, Chris Hall from Sioux City, asserted his power to demand a public hearing on the bill. That in the House, the minority party is allowed to call for a public hearing on certain bills. And that would have delayed everything. They would have had to wait and give public notice and have the hearing on a different day. So the Republicans ended up having a motion to suspend that rule that allows a member of the minority party to request a public hearing. And then they just proceeded with considering this charter school bill. And then they did another unusual procedural move where they limited the time of debate. Usually they can keep debating a bill as long as there are amendments that are germane to be considered. But a few times a year, the Republican majority has taken to establishing what they call a time certain. So they just cut off debate, even if there are a lot of amendments that haven't been considered. So the Democrats, needless to say, were really unhappy with how everything went down with this charter school bill. They felt that this is a far-reaching proposal, that we should have allowed more time for public input. They should have allowed more time for a fiscal note to be drawn up to find out what would be the budgetary impact. But instead, it ended up passing on a party line vote after midnight.
We joke about this. We weren't really joking. Charter schools were reacting because charter schools in the educational world are the third rail of education. Mm-hmm. You touch charter schools on either side, you die. It's sort of like Medicare. You never want to touch Medicare or Social Security or you die, right? And so charter schools bring out the worst in almost everybody in terms of the hyperbole, in terms of the maneuvering you're talking about.
Right. And, you know, on both sides, people always say it's about accountability, right? The proponents of charter schools say they want to give parents who feel that they're not well served by their local school district, they want to give them an option to start something else.
Right.
And then the opponents say that there's less accountability. I mean, there's been conflicting research about charter schools, but they're not subject to all the same oversight provisions. And there have been some real problems with substandard educational practices taking place. So that's why current Iowa law is really restrictive on charter schools. It can only be created by a public school district. And so this would be a really big departure.
Yeah, and Democrats often say, and they believe this, that charter schools are an effort to gut the public schools, to harm them.
Yes, I mean, an undetermined amount of funding would be redirected away from the public school to the private school. So that was the whole reason why the governor's original idea, which was a voucher type system where people who want to take their kids to private school get a certain amount of money from the state, that was the concern that especially in a lot of rural school districts where there aren't any existing private schools, that people would just take this money, maybe homeschool their kids. And in a small school district, if even 25 people pull their kids out of the district, you might have to cut some classes or fire a teacher. I mean, it could be really dire. So this charter school, I guess, was a compromise that the Republican caucus could live with, but the Democrats really felt that it hadn't been thoroughly vetted before it came to a vote on the floor.
Stay tuned. We'll be talking more about this, I'm pretty sure, in the next few days and weeks. Meanwhile, the state house, well, they were a little busy. They passed a proposed amendment to the Constitution, Iowa Constitution, to restore voting rights to people with felony convictions who have served their sentences, something Governor Reynolds has been asking for. The state house did that. And there's something else following that. But let's talk about this one. Restoring voting rights. That's a big deal.
Yes. So Governor Reynolds, in early 2019, she said it's time to change this provision in the Iowa Constitution that says people who have committed infamous crimes are barred from voting for life. In essence, that's what it says. And infamous crimes has been defined elsewhere in Iowa law as any felony. So even nonviolent felonies, felonies that people never served a day in prison for, just got sentenced to probation, those people have for many years been denied the right to vote. So the governor said, let's change this part of the Constitution. And in 2019, the Iowa House passed this constitutional amendment. They did their part. It was a 95-2 vote, and it went to the Senate, and it just didn't get out of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And last year, they tried again. to get this constitutional amendment. The Senate Judiciary Committee did vote it out, but it was never brought to the Senate floor. And so that means that you have to start the whole constitutional amendment process over. In Iowa, you have to have two separately elected legislatures have to approve the same language. So Governor Reynolds last summer issued an executive order that gave most people with felony convictions the right to get their voting rights back. But she still wants the Constitution changed because a future governor could just reverse her order the same way Terry Branstad did in 2011. He reversed an executive order that Tom Vilsack had issued that had allowed about 100,000 people with felony convictions to vote. So the Iowa House took this up. It passed unanimously this time, and it goes to the Senate. So we're just going to have to see what happens. That for some reason, the Senate Republican caucus has been more resistant to this idea of amending the Constitution.
Why do you think so?
It's really hard to say. I mean, I think that the one issue was that the Judiciary Committee Chair, Brad Zahn, was himself very opposed. He didn't like the idea of a blanket allowance for people to vote again. He wanted more financial strings attached. So he wanted people to be required to pay their full court fees, fines, and restitution. And the governor, in her executive order, she did not make any requirement that people have fully paid fines and fees. You know, a lot of people say that's tantamount to a poll tax because it means that two people who committed the same crime, the person who has plenty of spare money would be able to vote again, and the other person who's just living paycheck to paycheck might never be able to get those fines and fees fully paid. And, you know, that's an issue when people have a felony conviction. It's often difficult for them to get a job, difficult for them to find a place to live. So in any case, that the Judiciary Committee chair was a stumbling block in the past. And so to try to placate that sentiment in the Iowa Senate, the House passed a companion bill last week that would require at least the payment of restitution before someone could get their voting rights back. And most of the Democrats didn't support that. All of the Republicans did. So it was a unanimous vote to pass the constitutional amendment and then a mostly party line vote on this idea of requiring people to pay full restitution. And not all people with felony convictions have restitution assigned to them, but many people do.
Speaking of unanimous votes, House passed two bills last week unanimously that would give second chances to nonviolent felons and to those who've been evicted from wherever they live. This is the big deal. Well, let's unpack that one.
It is. And, you know, there are a lot of unanimous votes in the Iowa legislature. You don't hear about them because the bills tend to be non-controversial. But this one about the second chances for people with a felony conviction, that was unusual because it's a bill proposed by a Democrat, Mary Wolf. She represents the Clinton area. She's a defense attorney by occupation. And she proposed this idea that somebody with one, it wouldn't be somebody with a long list of criminal convictions. This would be one Class D felony. So that's the lowest level of felony. You could get that expunged, provided that you had fully completed your sentence and met your other obligations. And this would help a lot of people in the future, again, as I said, applying for a job, trying to get an apartment. And so she has promoted this idea, and the Republican majority actually took it up. I mean, most bills submitted by members of the minority party just never get a hearing at all. So that was unusual. It was brought to the floor, and it was passed unanimously. The other bill, which was related to, was similar. People who have an eviction in their past can get that removed from a state registry. That sometimes landlords look that up. And if you've ever been evicted, even if it wasn't your fault, even if it was circumstances outside your control, they might see that as a red flag and refuse to rent to you. So that was something proposed by Pete McRoberts. He's not a legislator, so he didn't formally propose it, but he's a policy director for the ACLU of Iowa. And it was an idea that he worked with legislators on getting that drafted. And I'm not sure how many thousands of people have ever been evicted in Iowa, but it's a substantial number of people who could potentially be helped by that bill if the Senate takes it up.
And do you think they will?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I'm going to be a little bit of a cynic here because sometimes in the legislature, we see this every year, that there are some bills that are passed unanimously by one chamber and then they never get heard. They never get through committee in the other chamber. So they just die quietly. But then the people in the one chamber can say, well, I voted for that bill. And so this might be one of those situations where I'm just not sure whether the Senate is on board with these ideas. And there's it's not related to criminal justice, but there is a similar bill where the House unanimously approved a bill that would allow telehealth that would require insurance companies to fully reimburse for telehealth appointments at the same rate as they do for in-person appointments. This is something that was part of the governor's disaster emergency proclamations related to COVID-19, but at some point she's going to lift those proclamations. So this is an attempt to make this permanent, that insurance companies would have to cover those costs, and it hasn't gotten a hearing in a committee in the Senate. So it passed the House unanimously, but it's looking like it's not going to go anywhere in the Senate. So this, it could be the same with these two second chance bills that passed the House last week.
Okay. It is 25 and a half after the hour. I'm giving that time cue for both you and me, Laura. So we're going to zoom through the rest of this Zoom gathering. State legislature passed a bill that is still on the governor's desk having to do with, well, what we might describe as housing discrimination. Now, I know you're going to write about this on your blog site, but talk about the bill and the prospects that federal funding could be at risk if that bill becomes law.
Well, one of the odd things about this bill is I'm not sure it actually is on the governor's desk. In the legislature, they passed this bill almost 2 weeks ago, but they don't always immediately forward bills to the governor. Sometimes they wait a week or two. And in this case, it looks like maybe more than 2 weeks. Because once they send the bill to the governor's desk, she only has 3 days to either sign or veto that. So sometimes there's a little bit of a negotiation where the governor's staff might say, can you hold off? We're still researching that bill. So I'm not sure what's going on with that. I would have expected her to make a decision on that bill by now. There are three cities, Des Moines, Iowa City, and Marion, which is a suburb of Cedar Rapids, that have ordinances that say landlords cannot discriminate on the basis of someone's source of income. And that means that if you get Section 8 vouchers, they can't refuse to rent to you just because you use federal housing vouchers. And this bill would say local governments cannot regulate that at all. So the proponents say this is a private property rights thing. We don't think that landlords should have to rent to people. And the opponents say this is just a backdoor route for housing discrimination. And many landlords who say, I don't want to take vouchers, it's really a proxy for saying they don't want to rent to low-income people, or they don't want to rent to people of color, because proportionally those populations are more likely to use the housing vouchers. So the federal Housing and Urban Development Director, Marsha Fudge, has said that if this becomes law in Iowa, and again, the governor hasn't signed it yet, but the feds are going to take a close look at this. And I talked to someone with the National Labor Employment Law Project or Housing Law Project last week, and she said that it's probably not something the federal government could challenge in court, but it might be something where they could hold back on some community development grants from the state of Iowa if they say that this is not in the spirit of the Fair Housing Act. It doesn't seem to violate the letter of the Federal Fair Housing Act, but there's a precedent related to the state of Connecticut where the feds withheld some housing funds, and that maybe, I don't know whether that's one of the issues the governor's staff are looking at, but that may be why we haven't seen any action on that bill yet. And I'm going to continue to follow that closely.
And you'll have it on your Bleeding Heartland website, blog site. You'll have that. 90 seconds. Yes. The governor is going to have to make a decision about a bill the legislature's passed to allow people to buy and carry concealed handguns. You've written about that on your blog site, a couple of blogs in recent days. Briefly talk about those.
Well, I think that the governor is probably going to sign that, but that this would mean that you don't have to have a permit to own, possess, or carry a handgun, a concealed weapon. You could still optionally apply for a permit, but you don't have to. And so, of course, the opponents of that say that this is going to make it very easy for people who can't pass a background check to just buy from unlicensed dealers, buy at gun shows, buy from any private seller. And these are people who couldn't pass the background checks that the sheriff's offices use now to determine who gets a permit. Right now, the concealed carry permits are good for 5 years, but you can't get one without a background check. So that's the main issue with this bill. But I do think the governor is going to sign it because all of the Republicans supported it, and she relies on that NRA endorsement, and she needs those voters to turn out next November. So I expect her to sign that bill.
Well, we have 30 seconds left. What are you expecting the legislature this week? What's coming up?
Well, it's a busy week because this is a second funnel deadline. We'll talk about next Monday what got through and didn't get through the funnel, but I expect dozens and dozens of bills to be considered this week in both chambers. It's going to be busy.
Dozens and dozens of bills, and you're going to follow each and every one of them, are you not?
Well, I'll try to follow the at least the most important ones.
All right, Laura, again, thank you so very much for being with us on this Monday night. It's always a pleasure.
I'll go so fast, Dennis, but I'll be back next week.
And we all will. That was Laura Bellin, who had dinner right before this broadcast and didn't tell me what she had. Doggone it, I think I'm getting hungry. We are just about out of time tonight and out of food. You've been listening to Capital Week right here on KHOI Community Radio in Ames and Story City. Laura Bellin and I will be right back here next Monday night, 7 o'clock with a look at what makes news in the Iowa State Legislature this week and what it means for each and every one of us. Until then, thank you for the privilege of your time and good night.